Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, May 22, 2014. The United Nations is asking Juba to stop harassing its workers in South Sudan.
The mission deplores the behavior of alleged members of the security forces who assaulted and illegally detained two of its staff members in separate incidents in Juba in recent days.
And the spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says it's a huge challenge to cater for South Sudanese crossing into the border.
We are receiving around 500 to 800 refugees a day. So our people receive them from the border, give them food and some basic supplies, including medical screening.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Military officials on both sides of the conflict say they have received reports of fighting this week in strategically important parts of Upper Nile State. The United Nations reports more than 2,000 people have crossed into neighboring Ethiopia within the past few days to escape the violence. Philip Aleu has the story for VOA from Juba.
Sudan People's Liberation Army spokesperson, Colonel Philip Aguirre, blames the opposition for starting this week fighting near oil fields. He says it started in Matiang at the beginning of the week and spread across Upper Nile State.
Yesterday, forces of Riek Machar violated the ceasefire in Nasser by shelling Nasser using mortars and artillery. The second violation is the attack on villages in Barliet County, in which four civilians were killed and more were wounded.
Clashes have been reported every day since President Salva Kiir and opposition leader Riek Machar signed a cessation of hostilities agreement in early May. Opposition military spokesperson Lou Rai Kwang says he has received reports of heavy fighting in Upper Nile since Monday, but his forces are not involved.
The version that I'm having is that there was fighting among government forces, and the people that sided on one side were some men, some Shuluk, and some Dinka from Upper Nile State. The three groups, they turned their guns against their colleagues from Greater Baragazal and those still loyal to the system.
Kwang says the government forces are also trying to provoke opposition forces into fighting in other areas of the state.
There was shelling yesterday. The government forces in Nasser, they shelled our position.
Aguirre dismissed both of Kwang's description. He says SPLA officials are documenting all of the fighting that is taking place so monitors can provide provocation later.
We are still issuing those warnings to the rebels to stop the violations. We have been notifying the monitors, the IGAD.
The Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, is expected to send the monitors, but it is not clear when that will happen. Officials say they are waiting for the regional troops to be deployed to offer protection, although no firm date has been set for the arrival. For BOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
Lucy Pony contributed to this report from Nairobi. The UNHCR spokesperson for Ethiopia says his country recently opened four more camps to accommodate all of South Sudanese refugees pouring across the border. Kesu Gebre Zaha tells South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam they see about 1,000 new South Sudanese refugees each day.
Mainly coming from the Upper Nile region of South Sudan. So the majority are women and children, and they keep coming.
Is that because there is still fighting going on in that region?
That's exactly what the new arrivals are telling us. Some are telling us that there are active fighting going on. Others are fleeing in anticipation of fighting. And the rainy season is quickly setting in, so most of them are afraid to stay on in case they get caught up in the fighting rage again.
I do want to ask you more about what you are providing them and their humanitarian needs, but I do want to ask you as well, are these people telling you who started the fighting, or do they tell you how the fighting was started?
No, actually, we don't even go into that kind of detail. Some of these people come long distance, hungry and thirsty. So we just ask them the basic questions and provide them with humanitarian supplies. So we don't even go deep into forcing them to point their accusing fingers on this or that.
Do most of the people arrive just with the clothes on their back?
Yes, and some very meager little belongings.
So what do you need to do then to help take care of these people?
What we're doing is we have our people on the ground at the reception centers. By the way, we have 3 active reception centers and entry points at the border. The most important one at the time is Burbe, where we're receiving around 500 to 800 refugees a day. So our people receive them from the border, give them food and some basic supplies, including medical screening and then registration. Then we move them to the refugee camps. In some of the locations, we have vulnerable groups, including children, sick, pregnant and lactating women, as well as the elderly. So for these people, because the road is really, really tough and difficult, we are using helicopter to relocate them to the camps and to health centers.
How many camps do you have? And when these people arrive, can you tell me what kind of condition most of them are in?
We now have 5 camps. The fifth was opened only last Saturday, because the number keeps growing and the existing camps have filled up. In most cases, particularly at the beginning, people were working for 15 to 20, 25 days. So they arrived at the border thirsty, dehydrated, and in really bad shape. So at the beginning, even the malnutrition rate was very high.
That's Kesuit Gebrezabe speaking to Carol Van Damme from Addis Ababa earlier today. One of the hardest hit areas by the conflict is United States Cochise County, which lies between Bentiu and Lare. Thousands of residents were displaced at the peak of the fighting. Though many have since returned, they have little food or shelter. World Relief's director for South Sudan, Darren Hader, tells my colleague Charlton Doki, many suffer from serious malnutrition.
Over the course of the last 5 months, we've seen the nutritional status of particularly children under the age of 5 has decreased, I would say, quite significantly and rapidly. And as far as the population in general, when the fighting passed through from Bentiu through Cochise County down to Lare towards the end of February, there was significant fighting in Mirmir, one of the communities, and Cochise town itself. And in Mirmir, you saw probably about 95% of the homes damaged or destroyed by the fighting. Coach was about 60%. And in those communities, from our most recent assessment, we've seen that most of the former inhabitants have returned. And so they're living in their compounds, they're living in their houses. The shelter they're getting from the rain that's coming right now is the trees that they had planted. And so there's need for shelter, non-food items, your cooking utensils, and then food as well to sustain the population throughout the coming months.
How else is the conflict affecting women and children, particularly in this area where you work?
With the conflict, health facilities have been looted, schools have been looted, and so the services that were there before, even though they were very basic a lot of times, are not there at all right now. And so seeking health care, it's not there. Schools for children are not operating as they should be either. So generally, the conflict, it's kind of been that maybe not directly targeting the women and children, but they suffer as a result of the destruction that comes from a result of the fighting.
How is World Relief responding to this situation?
Here we were able to fly some drugs into the county, which was able to sustain them for a few months until probably the end of February, beginning of March. And now we're exploring how we can get a second shipment into the county to support the clinics as well. Nutrition, we've been looking at monitoring the nutritional status so that we are able to alert the international community as to the need or the deterioration in the nutritional status of the residents in the county.
For malnutrition, what can be done in the short term to improve the situation?
Specifically looking at malnutrition of children, there's the need to restart the outpatient facilities that had been running alongside the health facilities, and then also to supplement that with outpatient therapeutic feeding sites.
It appears food insecurity and malnutrition in South Sudan are a common phenomenon. So what do you think needs to be done in the long term to avoid situations like that?
As an outsider, my ability to have an impact in South Sudan, I think, is limited. We've been trying to do it. Foreigners have been doing it for 15, 20 years, trying to work in South Sudan and address these same situations. And still, we're at the same spot. The solution is going to have to come from within South Sudan. I mean, I can give you the tools to do it, but you need to be able to do it. And so safety and security needs to return. Farmers need to be able to feel comfortable and confident that they can go out into their fields and plant and harvest. They need to be sure that when they do harvest, that food will actually be there for them throughout the lean season.
Darren Harder is the World Relief Country Director for South Sudan. He spoke with Charlton Doki in Juba earlier today. The United Nations says it's deeply concerned about fresh incidents of assault, detention, and harassment of two of its staff members in Juba. UN spokesperson in New York, Stephen Durich, wants the South Sudan government to punish security operatives who detain UN workers.
The UN mission remains concerned about incidents including assault, detention, and harassment of its staff that have recently occurred and exposed its personnel to serious security risks. The mission deplores the behavior of alleged members of the security forces who assaulted and illegally detained two of its staff members in separate incidents in Juba in recent days.
Dujarric is asking the government of South Sudan to act on the assurances given by President Salva Kiir to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon during his recent visit to South Sudan about the government's commitment to cooperate with UN mission in South Sudan.
The mission has asked the government of South Sudan to immediately investigate these violations and bring the perpetrators to justice. It also demands that all parties ensure unhindered freedom of movement to the United Nations and safety for its staff and humanitarian workers.
That's the United Nations spokesperson Stephanie Jurek speaking to reporters at the UN headquarters in New York yesterday. As we reported on Tuesday, former rebel leader David Yao Yao returned to Juba following signing of a peace agreement between his South Sudan Democratic Movement and Army and the government in Juba. In Jonglei State's Bibor County, Bishop Paul Yugusuk is the spokesperson of the church-led team that mediated the government's talks with Yao Yao's group. Bishop Paul tells Charlton Doki, the mediators are now working to reconcile communities in the greater Pibor area.
We believe as mediators that this agreement was signed between the two parties and they are committed and is going to hold. The minorities in Jonglei State, that is the Murle, Kachipa, Anyuak, and Jie, are going to be part of this administrative unit. And our task now, following the signing of the peace, is to reconcile the community. And that's our objective as church leaders. We were only involved in the peace agreement because there was no any option, you know, to pave the way for community reconciliation at the grassroots level. And that's our task. We want to see the Anyuak live in harmony with each other, with their neighbors, the Murle, the Denka, the Nuer. And we believe that this administrative area, first of all, it has brought about peace in Jonglei.
What is going to happen next now that the agreement has been signed?
The agreement has to be taken to the Council of Ministers. It has to be passed. This is the first process. And following then, the appointment of the Greater Bibor Administrative Area and the Chief Administrator with the two deputies, Deputy for Finance and Administration and then a Deputy for Service. After that, then the establishment of the counties, the six counties, they have been given six counties. Of course, these counties are subject to assessment. There will be a committee that will go to the ground and see how these counties will be established. And then the council, which is comprised of 36 persons, that is their small parliament, if you like. So there is a lot to be done. who first wanted to see how this agreement will be passed by the Council of State.
How long will this area continue to have a special administrative status? And what mandate will its administration have?
Of course, the first thing that we would like to see is passing of the agreement by the Council of State. Then now you will talk of law. As it stands now, it's just an agreement. We want to believe that it will be passed, and thereafter then it will have the mandate. It will have its authority. Of course, when you talk of this agreement, we have the bigger crisis. And you know that our country is undergoing a constitution-making process. And all this will depend on the bigger crisis, on the bigger reconciliation. If we have a constitution, for instance, that gives us federalism, then of course this agreement will cease. But one important thing is that since last year up to now, war has stopped in Greater Bibor. There is no bloodshed. And now the Greater Bibor is a zone of peace.
Some people argue that this agreement will set a bad precedent because every community will begin to ask for a special administrative status. What do you say to this?
This is what we have been here, but I don't think, you know, the issue of the Murle community has been there. You know, Jongle was the problem. I don't think that anybody will just pick a gun and will say, okay, because you have picked a gun, let's give you administrative area. The issue of Murle is very exceptional. It's a historic issue. It has taken quite some time, the desired administrative area, for solving their problem and the problem of South Sudan.
That was Bishop Paul Yogusuk of the Episcopal Church of Sudan. He's the spokesperson of the church-led team that mediated talks with David Yaoyao's South Sudan Democratic Movement Cobra faction.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
To protect yourself and your family from sickness and disease, it's important to be careful about water. Bottled water is safe to drink and cook with. But if you can't buy it, be sure to purify your water by boiling it or treating it with an approved water sanitation kit. To destroy microorganisms that cause disease or even kill, you need to boil water for at least 5 minutes. Then wait to allow any sediment to settle and let the water cool down before drinking. To help protect you, your children, and your family from sickness, make sure all your water is safe to drink.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Millions of newborn babies die each year, but attention to newborn health is a low priority for many countries. That story is coming up.
You don't want to miss VOA's South Sudan in Focus, and there are now a number of options for listening. You can hear us on one of our FM affiliate stations around the country. Check out our website, voanews.com/South Sudan, for the listings. In Juba, you can listen to South Sudan in Focus at 8 p.m. on 93.5, VOA's 24-hour station. You can also find us on the following shortwave frequencies, 11620, 13870, and 15180 kilohertz. Or you can listen on the web at www.voanews.com/South Sudan. You can also download our podcast on iTunes. That's South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the most important thing you look for in a potential spouse?
It is good to choose a woman that can understand you also in terms of sharing the ideas in the family also, and to unite children or to unite the kid in the family also, and to make your children also to grow very well when you have the same ideology with the woman.
When I look at my girlfriend, she's not perfect, but I feel good being with her for one reason. This is someone who will take me from the level I am to another level. She sees my ambition. And she loves me because I'm ambitious.
That person must have everything that can give care to me so that I can cannot starve in future.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. Despite 5.5 million newborn and stillborn baby deaths each year, investment in newborn health remains very low. That's one of the findings in a series of papers published in the medical journal. The research also shows the vast majority of those deaths could be prevented. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Lead researcher Joy Long says the research is the most accurate estimate yet on the number of deaths of newborns and stillbirths.
Every year, there are 2.9 million babies who die in the first month of life, and most shockingly, a million who die on their birthday, the first day. And there are 2.6 million stillbirths, most shockingly, 1.2 million who die while the woman is in labor. So together, this is 5.5 million babies.
Most of the deaths are in low and middle income countries, but rich nations, she says, are not immune. There are about 500,000 preterm births in the United States every year.
The three leading causes around the world are preterm birth complications, so where women don't get the right care during labor, and babies that are full term can have damage and even die because of lack of care during labor, and then thirdly, infection.
Lawn is a professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and an advisor to Save the Children UK. She says many babies and their mothers could be saved for just a few dollars worth of medical care.
In this series, we show very clearly that 71% of newborn deaths can be prevented with solutions that we have already, and that together 3 million women, babies, counting newborns and stillbirths, could be saved every year with investment at the time of birth. So that's a triple return on investment with care at the time of birth.
That care includes simple things like keeping the baby warm, helping it learn to breastfeed, and making sure it has skin-to-skin contact with its mother. Also, Lawn says there are injections that can greatly improve the odds of a baby's survival. One injection prevents tetanus infections, a nearly always fatal condition for babies. Another contains corticosteroids and is given to women in preterm labor. Corticosteroids affect stress and immune response and inflammation. They help premature babies improve their breathing. This is standard treatment in rich nations, but not in developing countries. It costs less than a dollar. Lawn says it's been known for many years that a large number of newborns die, yet funding to prevent the problem remains low.
Of the billions of dollars that are given for child survival, only 4% of that donor funding even mentions the word newborn. And yet 44% of under five deaths are among newborns. So there's a major mismatch in what the funding is going to compared to where the deaths are now.
Much of the funding goes towards preventing deaths of mothers and children up to age five. In recent years, it's become more common in the U.S. to issue birth certificates for stillborn babies. Lawn says it means a lot to parents to know that their child has been recognized. However, what the papers in The Lancet also show is that in many developing countries, no record is kept.
A woman who loses a newborn death or a stillbirth in many of the places I've worked in Africa, there will be no piece of paper. The baby may not be named. It's very unlikely there will be any funeral or public recognition. And those things aren't just sad for the woman, but they hide the whole problem. The fact that in this day and age you can have 5.5 million babies entering and leaving the planet without official records, but also mostly without funerals or recognitions, actually stops us acting.
More than 50 experts from 28 institutions in 17 countries took part in the Lancet series. In June, a new international initiative is set to be launched called Every Newborn Action Plan. It's described as an evidence-based roadmap toward care for every woman and a healthy start for every newborn baby. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Somali militant groups Al-Shabaab has vowed to shift its war to neighboring Kenya by sending more fighters to launch attacks against the government and civilians there. The group also called on Muslim communities in Kenya to take up the fight. Muhammad Yusuf has the details for VOA from Nairobi.
Al-Shabaab on Monday ambushed a Kenyan army convoy in the northeast, close to the border with Somalia, killing at least 10 soldiers. Speaking Thursday in the Somali town of Badere, Al-Shabaab commander Fuad Mohamed Khalaf said the attackers were youths from Kenya. We have trained youths from Kenya and we will be sending them back to their country, he said. The ones we have sent on Monday who have killed your soldiers are the ones you have wronged, and we will send more. A United Nations report in 2011 said Al-Shabaab had recruited as many as 500 Kenyan youths. Since then, Kenyan police have arrested dozens of suspected recruits who have crossed back into Kenya. Investigators have said that two recent attacks in Nairobi on a commuter bus and a busy local market were carried out by Kenyan nationals. On Wednesday, a court arraigned an 18-year-old Kenyan, Wague Sarr. The teenager was charged with planting an explosive device in a commuter bus earlier this month. Al-Shabaab's Khalaf warns the Kenyan government to prepare for more attacks. We are telling them you should be ready to be kidnapped, for women and young male suicide attackers, and for more Muslims to fight you. This week, Kenyan fighter jets attacked an Al-Shabaab stronghold and training bases as part of an African Union operation against the group. Kenyan forces crossed into Somalia in 2011 to fight Al-Shabaab. Since then, Kenya has faced a wave of deadly grenade, bomb and gun attacks. Most notably, Al-Shabaab militants killed more than 60 people in their attack on Nairobi's Westgate shopping mall last year. Last month, security officials in Nairobi launched a crackdown to nab terrorists, their sympathizers and illegal immigrants. Rights groups have complained about the operation, which targeted Somali immigrants in the Isli neighborhood of Nairobi. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now take you to Ghana for some high life music, and this one is by Aforim Ponsa. Been listening to Aforim Ponsa with the song Bon Frere. I'm afraid I could not resist the temptation to dance. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you back tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.